From Directions Media, this is Directions on the News for Tuesday, March 25th, 2008. This is Adina Schutzberg, and I'm joined by my colleague, Joe Francica. Each week, this podcast examines topics of interest to the geospatial community. And this week, we round up some of the recent week's news. We're going to take a look at Google opening up its editing platform, the ESRI Developer Summit, and news from indoor positioning and RFID. But first, a word from our sponsor.
This podcast is brought to you by ESRI. Experience the geographic advantage with ESRI's ArcGIS server, a comprehensive platform for cost-effectively delivering enterprise GIS applications. Learn more about ArcGIS server at www.esri.com/directionsmag.
With this past week's announcement from Google, now anyone, not just people who are associated with a particular business at a particular location, can edit information on Google Maps. There's a couple caveats. That sounds like a free-for-all, and it's not really. You can only edit points of interest. You can only edit them in the U.S., Australia, and New Zealand. And some of those you can't edit at all, things like government buildings, hospitals, and so forth. There's also some moderating going on in the sense of if you move something more than 200 yards or 200 meters, it gets moderated. And the editing itself really boils down to moving a point, adding a point, deleting a point, or updating the attributes of a point. It also has some interesting comparisons to some of the other systems that are out there to gather feedback from different users. So the TomTom solution, MapShare, allows a whole nother layer of editing in terms of changing one-way streets, closing streets that end, and things like that. So it's much more complete, I would say. There's also a barrier to entry in the sense that you have to have a TomTom device that supports it. You can also contrast this with the tools that Navtech and TeleAtlas have to provide information about updates to their geodatabases. And as you pointed out in the past, Joe, those can be just really challenging to work with, and people don't know about them, and they didn't bother. One thing I have to say about Google's implementation is it really is easy, and you can just jump in there and start correcting things if they're wrong. The one other thing I'll point out is that this is a real step for Google to be in the geodata business, even if at this point it's only in terms of managing points of interest. But I think that's an important step.
Well, so let me get the facts straight. What people were able to do is essentially feedback to Google points of interest locations that users might find incorrect, changed.
Or if something's missing, you can add a new one, yes.
So how are they making this into a wiki, or what do you feel is their objective here?
It's been described as a wiki, and it isn't in the sense that you're really working right in the application itself and your changes do appear immediately. If you look at a point of interest and it has been changed in Google Maps, it will be noted. And, of course, you have to be logged in to a Google account to make that change so they can sort of track who's doing what in case there's trouble. I think what they're really trying to do is capture the wisdom of the masses and ultimately perhaps make that ultimate points of interest database. Now, the real question for me is what happens to that database beyond Google Maps? Is this something that, for example, they provide an API to that can be used in other applications? That was sort of my first thought.
Boy, that would be challenging. The whole aspect of user-contributed information is starting to get really murky. From a commercial side, as you mentioned, we get TeleAtlas and Navtech, TomTom. From a community side, we have Google, we have OpenStreetMap. So who's the source here? Who's going to find the source relevant, useful?
Valid.
Valid. I think it raises a bunch of questions.
Well, and it's one more player in that space, and I think it's going to be interesting to watch how these different groups learn from each other about the best ways to do it. The ESRI Developer Summit was held last week, and while I'm not a developer and you're not a developer, I'm sure many of our listeners are sort of keyed into what happened there. From reading all the coverage in the blogs, and there's quite a bit, we'll provide some links to that in the show notes, sort of four things struck me as sort of being important. And three of those are really new APIs for developers to use. New in the sense of they're not the same old APIs that we've been hearing about. One of those is a REST API, and recall that REST stands for Representational State Transfer. And it's basically a software architecture vision for what are called hypermedia systems, that is, things web-based and otherwise. REST isn't that old. It only came into being in 2000. And what's really exciting about it from the developer's standpoint is it's really all about how resources are defined and addressed within a programming environment. So that had an awful lot of discussion. People are very excited about a REST API for ESRI products. There's also a lot of focus on a JavaScript API. JavaScript isn't Java, and it's not really even related to Java, but it's a scripting environment. It's easy to use. It's mostly used for client-side development for web applications. Again, something that people are really hot about. And the third API is the Flex API. And Flex is a development environment from Adobe for internet apps. Again, it's based on Flash. So that's another sort of up-and-coming environment, sort of new for the ESRI environment. So all of that got the developers a buzz. The one other thing that popped out to me that I think is a real sort of telling point about how ESRI is thinking about its place within the geospatial and larger IT community is some new tools, some extenders that allow you to take ArcGIS server-created services right into a Google Maps or Virtual Earth environment. And I think a lot of people who've been looking at the different options that are out there want very much to take the power of the back-end analytics that ESRI offers and connect them up with some of these more consumer-facing and more casual user-facing interfaces like Google Maps and Google Earth. So I think that's a really powerful statement right there.
Well, it sounds like it's a change in tone from ESRI, that this is now a directional shift for them to open up more of their platforms and to, I don't know what you want to say, more democratize their analytical capabilities. I mean, you said it yourself. I mean, they want to provide more access to the back functionality that perhaps previously hasn't been exposed. And I think that's a bit of a change from what we've seen from ESRI. Do you feel that way?
I think ESRI is very wise in its conservative nature, and that's something that people are sort of comfortable with, that ESRI doesn't jump into things. They really wait for things to settle down before they decide a path. And I'll be honest, I think they waited for a number of years to watch what Google and what Microsoft and some of the other players were doing in terms of the impact that their offerings were going to have on our community, and then made the decision of how they're going to react, and in this case, interact with those platforms. So it is a bit of a switch, and I think, I'm looking forward to the summer, to the user conference, to see again how that's positioned for those in the end user role of ESRI software as opposed to those who are third-party developers. I think that's an important subtle sort of changes, as you point out, that came out of this meeting. The event itself got wonderful reviews. The developer community seems very, very excited. And I have the sense that ESRI is taking on more and more commitment to that developer community.
I don't think they want to lose the rapport that they've had with developers because of the competition. Let's move on to a third topic that I wanted to discuss, and it's a sort of a collection of news items that I've seen over the past couple weeks. It has to do with RFID, radio frequency identification, and some of the things that we look at in terms of positioning is, how is this type of technology impacting what we do in the location space? I had a news item from ABI Research, in particular what China is doing with enabling RFID government ID cards. It's a big initiative that they've had over there. They're bringing this test program to a close and sort of rolling it out to a larger community. So I just wanted to point out that it's a relatively large initiative that they've had. Rolling it out now involves animal tagging, again, I guess, to track safety and security issues for food production. They're going to do more with public transportation and issuing RFID-based public transportation cards. again, a lot in with respect to what's going on for the coming 2008 Olympic Games. What they're trying to do is manage more efficiently. I would assume that they're going to look at the volume of traffic that they're getting on public transportation, looking where their flows are, and that's an interesting application. A lot of what RFID has done in the past is trying to look at asset management. Of course, in the case of China, the asset here is people. One of the things that also came up in the past week was the whole initiative, at least in the United States, has been done by either the U.S. government for military applications or Walmart. Walmart put into place kind of a mandate to their suppliers to put RFID on all of the pallets. One individual pointed out from RFID Gazette recognized that they had a shift going on, that the rollout of RFID in distribution centers wasn't quite working, such that once the asset or the product reaches the distribution center, it's essentially invisible. You don't see it going out. While they can count the asset coming in, there's nothing going on at the store level. So what they want to do is look more at what's going on at a store-level environment, whether they could integrate that type of technology into the supply chain, because there's a big gap there. They want to monitor product. They don't want to monitor the large pallet. What we've seen now in RFID technology is kind of a move to get more personal, more down to a higher level of granularity. You see it here in China trying to get down to more the RFID tickets, and you see it here with Walmart trying to get down to a product level. This type of application, this type of technology is becoming more personal, again, bringing up some of the issues of privacy, but still what we're trying to do is get down to a finer level of positioning with the technology, and it's something that I've just observed here recently.
I think it's an important trend, and I guess I have to challenge both of those situations in the sense of to get the end user on board with both of these initiatives and probably a whole host of other ones that we didn't mention, there's got to be return to the individual. So here in Boston, we have RFID-based cards to use public transportation. Now, right now, I have a card, and they don't know I bought it. They don't know which card I have. So they know there is somebody moving through the system with a certain pattern, but they don't know it's me, and that's fine. There's a benefit to me to use it because if I use one kind of transportation and then another, I get a discount when I transfer. It basically does an automatic transfer. So that has value. The real trick, if they want to know where I am, if that's important, as I have a particular demographic background, whatever, the value there is if I register this card and I lose it, the value of it can be made available to me. But if I don't register it and I lose it, I'm out however much money was on the card. By the same token, if they're going to put an RFID tag in the jacket that I buy, which is going to allow them to know that, well, for example, I purchased it and then took it out of the store, that might be valuable information, what value does that have to me after I leave the store? Does that mean that if I go to return it some years later because it failed, they can look at that tag and know that I bought it there? Is that enough of a value for me to sort of buy into this and, this potential invasion of my privacy? Those, I think, are the issues that need to be looked at from the sort of consumer perspective.
Yeah, I think there's going to have to be a way to turn off those chips to avoid the privacy issue. All they need to know that is it left the store, not necessarily the personal aspect of it. If there is some frequent buyer program that you want to opt into, you want to say how you used it, how you used the product, what the benefit of it is, there's got to be some return. At this point, it's mainly to the supplier, to the manufacturer. But you can see the trend going. You can see that it's coming down to a more individual product level.
Well, that's all the time we have today. Before we go, our sponsor, ESRI, would like to invite you to be part of the 2008 ESRI Business GIS Summit, April 27th to the 30th in Chicago, Illinois. You're invited to join other industry professionals and commercial executives to learn how GIS can be used to make your business more profitable. For more information, visit www.esri.com/directionsmag. If you've got questions or comments on today's podcast or anything else, please email us at editors@directionsmag.com. Thanks for joining us today, and be sure to tell a friend.